You're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com, bringing you the freshest radio in Brooklyn since 2009. Hear directly from chefs to farmers, artists to architects, authors to brewers, and everyone in between. Check out all of our shows on our website or by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. The following program has been brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery. Cane Vineyard and Winery supports Heritage Radio and the growing movement to change how Americans eat and how we think about our planet. For more information, visit www.cane5.com.
Welcome to Hot Grease. I'm your host, Nicole Taylor. This Heritage Radio Network program is brought to you by Cane Vineyards and Wine. Every week on Hot Grease, we bring people back to what's great in food, culinary traditions, cooking at home, knowing your farmer, or even growing your own food. I spotlight good food fighters and the culture of the good food movement, from chefs to tastemakers to moms on a budget. Today, we'll be talking food headlines, milk not jails, and the hot five. If you're listening live to Heritage Radio Network, we have a call-in number, folks. Give us a call. Our number here at the studio is 718-497-2128. Okay, people, in the studio to talk food headlines is Lauren
Melodia.
See, that's going to be my new thing. Lauren is a social change activist living in Brooklyn, New York. So first food headline, and this is really not a food headline, but I'm always talking about food in Bed-Stuy, so I thought I'd bring this up. Last week, the New York Times writes an article titled "Striking Change in Bedford-Stuyvesant as the White Population Soars." This article is like all over social media. Everyone is talking about it. And basically what they're saying that Bed-Stuy is 60% black, and over a decade ago, it was 75% black. So I have to ask you how you feel about this. You're a pretty, I would say, a long-term Bed-Stuy resident.
Well, I'm not three generations.
But you've like been Melissa. There for the, yeah, like yeah. Melissa Danielle. Everyone knows Melissa. She's been on the show. But you've been there before the, like, this real, like, hipster wave that's happening now.
For sure. I mean, I feel like when I moved there 8 years ago, I didn't know. All my friends lived way far outside of the neighborhood, and I was really excited about the neighborhood because it's such a family neighborhood and a place where a lot of community involvement was taking place, a lot of community action, but I didn't have any like close friends there. Now everybody that I know lives in Bed-Stuy, it seems, but they're not really that interested in community activism.
Yeah, I think the coolest thing about the article is that one of the professors or the professionals quoted in the article had said essentially some of the folks that are moving to the neighborhood have absolutely no clue about like the real history, like political history and the social capital and circles that are in Bed-Stuy amongst black people. And yeah, that's where that's the real problem lies.
Yeah, well, it's just sad. I mean, one of the amazing things about New York is there are these neighborhoods that are always changing. There's always things happening in them. And cultures are constantly coming together and clashing and building new culture. And if you don't know anything about the neighborhood you're moving into, you're really missing out on that.
True that. And we all know that Bed-Stuy, and I've said it here before, is becoming the new food destination in New York City, more so in Brooklyn. But I think I'm going to have to put a note on that to say that there are a lot of businesses that are opening that are new in Bed-Stuy that are actually black owned.
Yeah.
So I don't want folks to think that hipsters are the only folks that are opening businesses.
That's true. I mean, I think a lot of people walk down Lewis Ave and they think, oh, this is gentrification here. This is all white. But it's actually tons of black owned businesses.
True.
And that's
that.
Really exciting.
It is. Next, another New York Times article. New York Times need to pay me for keep talking about their article. Basically, this next article was posted online, published August 5th, and it's about community gardens that are being, I guess, ripped off. People are stealing food from them. Oh, do I feel sad about this?
I don't understand why this is a big deal. Every time I've ever been involved in a community garden, I've always wanted people to steal the food from the garden.
That's what I'm saying. I'm like,
there's so much.
I'm like, okay, is this newsworthy? Well, hey, they're getting the food. Great. So yeah, we kind of feel the same way about that. I didn't read the comments. You know, sometimes the comments on New York Times, I don't think this is one that has comments on it, can be really crazy, but I'm like, great. People are stealing food. That means they're hungry.
Yeah. They're stealing good food. That's great.
So, next article actually written by a friend of the show on silverleaks.com. Adriana Valles wrote A Tell-All Guide to Artisanal Butchery. I think this is pretty much a review of the book by, Josh and Jessica Applestone. For some of you folks who are listening now, you may know them as the folks behind Fleischer's Meat in upstate New York. What do you think about this whole butchery, good food, grass food movement?
Well, I'm a vegetarian, but I know a lot of people are really getting into meat these days. People say it's like the new vegan or something, you know, total opposite. But people are excited about local food and really trying to source things locally. And I don't know. It's crazy how there's all these new fancy knives and cuts that people are talking about. I don't understand any of it. But I know people going off to far off places to learn artisanal butchery. And
yeah, they're going to, I mean, one of the most famous places is Fleischer's. And these are the folks who wrote the book. So I have to ask you this, since this is kind of about the food headline. Are you one of those crazy vegan folks?
No, I'm not vegan.
Okay,
I mean, I am involved in a campaign called Milk Not Jail, so I couldn't possibly be.
Uh-huh.
But I was vegan for a long time. And I do, I've lived in collective houses for a long time. I've always lived in like a vegetarian or vegan house. Now I'm the only vegetarian in my house.
Oh, really?
Yeah, everybody eats meat.
Are these folks that are basically have realized that there's great beef out there and they've converted over to the good beef like the Fleischer's meat?
I think a good amount of my roommates have spent time on farms where they've gotten to know the animals that their friends are raising and had that meat and think that it makes sense in their worldview and their relationship to food.
Okay, speaking of meat, a food headline, this was last week. This is disturbing. Every time I hear or read about one of these recalls, it's just like, ugh. Cargill recalls 36 million pounds of ground turkey. This is a damn shame. When they do these recalls, I don't even see what they're telling people to do. They tell people to go back and get a refund. What the hell is someone supposed to do when they recall turkey?
I don't know. I don't think people get a refund for that stuff, do they?
I don't know. It's linked to a nationwide salmonella outbreak that has killed one person in California and sickened at least 76 others. And this article and what I'm reading here is from Cuisine Nord magazine, their culinary scoop that they send out every week.
So it's the thing that's most disturbing about these recalls is they've got such a massive quantity of food that's moved probably from like 12 different processing plants and storage facilities to the point that they have no idea where like the piece of whatever turkey in California that killed someone actually came from. So they just recall everything that the entire like corporate entity has produce. It's just disturbing that it really demonstrates that you have no idea where your food's coming from if you're buying any of these like multinational.
Do you think this really, the recalls really like shake people up and they don't want ground turkey forever? Or what happens to the conscience of the person that's really buying commodity meat?
I'm the wrong person to ask for that.
I'm just curious.
The egg recall last year, did people get squeamish about it? The thing that's funny is that
I don't eat regular eggs, so
the one recall that I remember people still getting squeamish about is when they like recalled a bunch of spinach.
Oh yeah.
And I feel like people would be like, oh, you eat spinach? I don't know. Remember that recall?
Yeah, it's something.
It's
yeah.
It's like meat that's diseased seems just as sketchy as spinach.
Speaking of Big Ag, this is our last food headline. We could go on and on, actually, the whole entire show with the food headlines. Chicago Tribune, I actually found this by way of Food 52. They're doing food news on their website now. There was an article in the Tribune, food companies forking over free lunches to needy kids in the summer. So PepsiCo trucks loaded with food pass through apartment complexes on the south side of Chicago. And they're giving away other companies, ConAgra Foods, Subway restaurants. They're giving away carrots, juice, and a whole bunch of other stuff to kids in South Side of Chicago. Your thoughts on this?
My thoughts. Well, I don't think corporate America is going to save anyone here. So,
yeah, I think I was talking. We were talking a little bit from the show. I wish we had recorded that conversation. I'm kind of torn because I realized that I remember going to camp in Athens back in what, the 80s. And they gave away free lunches. I mean, free lunches and snacks. The food was absolutely horrible. And so my aunt would pack up my own lunch and I didn't eat the food. It was bad. Bad in terms of the taste wasn't good. So we know that there's a huge percentage of kids all over the country that really depend and need this food. So I'm like, and I know that, you know, government, they're cutting these summer lunch programs. So how can someone who's listening, all my food fighter friends out there, we need a new model like to bring fresh food to kids during the summer.
Well, I think this is taking place in Chicago, right?
It is.
I mean, we already have some outstanding examples of people doing creating new models with food there, like Growing Power has expanded from Milwaukee to now Madison, Milwaukee, and Chicago.
Yeah.
I think Will Allen could probably solve this better than PepsiCo could.
Yeah, his daughter runs the Chicago operations. All right, folks. So that's your food headlines for the month of August. Keep listening. We're going to take a short break and come back with more Lauren.
So, after some time. Yeah. Guys.
Now you know and I know I done bumped every hole in the wall, y'all. Did you catch that phone call? Most of y'all done met me. Thought I was tall. Yeah, flip like a deal. Zip, fell on the black ice. Did you think twice? Home slice came and he went satisfied. Got bent bars and mutant coast to coast. Yeah, I left the boat. Man, those. Too many coming close. Cause touch what I never touched before. Seen what I never seen before. Woke up and seen the sun. Sky high. Sky high. Circulate like a Sunday paper. Papers caught long time. The cheap flicks. Good picks. Pay hard. Watch the heart turn sideways. Cause the tail. For real sales to those with loose cash flares. Give you life for now. Feeling good and warm. Windows roll tight. 35 degrees. Nip it at night. Don't forget the chapstick. Lips dry quick. When the jack out. Make you want to act out. Take the slack out. Some people black out.
Welcome back to Hot Grease on the Heritage Radio Network. Check out our program schedule and show archives on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. Social change agent, food activist, community organizer. We hear about all these individuals shaping a new world, but what is their day-to-day life really like? Lauren.
Yes.
Is a co-founder of a Brooklyn-based CSA and organizer from Milk Not Jails is still with us, and she's going to give us a glimpse into the world of an organizer, a social change agent, all those things. So when folks come up to you and they're like, Lauren, what do? Describe your gig.
Well, it changes every day depending on what's happening in the world. And it's also changed over time.
So I know I mentioned that you're a founder of a Brooklyn-based CSA. You're actually the founder of the Bed-Stuy Farm Share, a.k.a. community-supported agriculture, and one of the main organizers for Milk Not Jails.
Yes.
So how do you explain that to folks?
Explain what exactly?
When you say, oh, I'm the founder of a CSA, and they're looking like, okay, what does that mean? Milk Not Jails,
Well, I think everybody thinks I get paid for both of those projects.
Aha, see, that's what
not I was... true. I mean, I do get paid in produce, that's for sure.
That's always
I've gotten
good.
To eat really well from the Bed-Stuy Farm Share the past 6 years. But I started that project when I was working part-time and then later full-time at the Center for Constitutional Rights. So I feel like my activist work has kind of fluctuated between being volunteer efforts and paid jobs that I've had. And both have been really rewarding and exciting. Right now, though, I don't have any income except the produce that I get from the
CSA. Hey, you're eating every day.
Yeah.
And I think as a person who I consider myself a food justice activist or activist in general, I mean, I've been working in nonprofits on and off, free and unpaid for the last 10 years. I think that's a big misconception. People don't realize that it's like the bottom of the barrel, lower paying job, or most of the times when you're doing really cool projects, you're not getting paid at all.
Right. Well, it seems like the coolest projects are the ones that are kind of really at the grassroots, unfunded, because that's the space where people can really still be innovative and make kind of creative choices. That's where Milk Nut Jails came out of. I got a fellowship through the Open Society Foundation to investigate some economic obstacles to criminal justice reform. And that fellowship ended in February, but I had the freedom there, obviously funded, very well funded, to kind of negotiate the space that I was, you know, interested in creating radical change in and be innovative and come up with this project that I'm really excited about. And now I'm just wanting, I want to keep it going. I want to keep the ball rolling and turn this project into not just a theory of social change, but a real model that people can use in other states. So my day-to-day life is taking care of my basic subsistence needs. Like, the first thing I do when I wake up is I feed our backyard chickens.
I didn't realize you had chickens. Yeah. How many?
Well, we had six until like 2 weeks ago. Then one of them mysteriously disappeared.
Oh, maybe someone needed dinner.
Maybe. Oh. And that's fine. If they wanted to steal the chicken for that, that's cool.
So you get up. So that means you're getting up at like six.
Yeah.
Damn.
I mean, luckily, I don't hear them as loud as some of my other roommates, but I'm usually the first one up. But I bring that up just to say that I feel like what I try and do with the farm share and that is have these other things that aren't like jobs where I get paid a wage. Yeah. To help me take care of my basic subsistence so that I don't have to be working full time, you know, so that I can have the space to be involved in projects that aren't funded.
And I want to talk about having an idea, because I think there are plenty of people who are probably listening to Hot Grease here on the East Coast and the West Coast that have tons of ideas in terms of social change and the food system. How does one come up with an idea and then take it to an actual project that's affecting people's lives? What would you say are some of the first steps or some of the things that you did to get a project from idea in your head to this is a real deal thing?
Well, I think there's two things. One is some people think that they need to have the perfect plan in order. Like they need to know all of the players. They need to have all of the kinks worked out before they even pilot something. And I don't think that that's necessarily the right approach to take, because you learn the most about creating change or pushing, you know, political changes forward by just trying things out and seeing if they work or not, you know? So the first year we started the CSA, for example, I'd never ran a CSA before. I just printed up flyers and put them up in every bodega, you know, and waited for people to call. But I didn't know the first thing about really managing that in the city and making people feel connected to the farmers that were producing the food 2 hours away. And we've hit a lot of bumps on the road over the past 6 years with that project. But every year it gets stronger in some ways, or maybe we'll make a change that makes it too complicated or too stressful or something. But at least we're trying things out and making mistakes and learning from them. And then I think the second thing is that the only way you're really going to carry an idea forward is if you have other people involved.
Totally.
So a lot of times people like come up with an idea, maybe put it out there, you know, on Facebook or talk about it to their friends at the bar or something like that. But I think really hitting the pavement, talking to people. I'm like a huge fan of doing street outreach just to try and get people, because I mainly work on community-based projects, you know, but talking to people in my community about things.
Speaking of community and projects, so I associate you with two projects, and I just want to make sure that I'm not missing any other projects. Milk Not Jails. Uh-huh. When someone says that, I'm like, oh yeah, I know the person that's doing that. And then the Bed-Stuy CSA. Are you working on any other cool projects around food or social justice?
I think those are the two main projects I'm working on right now. The other one is just turning my house into some sort of like ecological, sustainable experiment, which is, you know, a personal space, but we try and open it up to get other people to, you know, experience it as much as possible. Like this weekend we had a rainwater harvesting workshop that we did where we set up a rainwater harvesting system at the house, and it was open to the farm share members and other people in the area that are interested in those kinds of systems. So that's a way that like that space is where I live, but it's also very much a project.
But that's changing people's lives. I mean, that's what it's all about.
Those are the three main things I'm focused on right now though.
Cool. So I have just one last question. Do you have any advice for young people or people who are like, you know, we're in our 30s. I know folks that are in their 40s and 50s who are trying to change careers. They're trying to move to the food side in terms of not only I just want to, you know, make some food or cook for someone, but they want to have this social component, social justice component. What is the biggest piece of advice that you would give someone? Well, besides, you're not going to make any money.
Right. That's what I was going to say. I've yet to get a job in that field. Well, I think that there's a lot of hype around local food and food justice right now. There's a lot of major foundations that are funding projects at pretty large nonprofits around the country. So one might think like there's so much opportunity there, but it's also a really bad time economically. I think one of the things that I'm interested in doing is not relying on foundation funding so much as building social enterprises.
Yeah.
Like, let's learn how to actually make sustainable businesses. So if people have ideas about things they want to change that involve food and involve material goods that they want to sell to people, even if it's like a non-market-based system, try and figure out how to make the operational costs covered.
Exactly.
You know? And that's what we're trying to do with both the Farm Share and Milk Not Jails right now.
Okay, Lauren Maluda.
Melodia.
Melodia. Why do I? You know, I mean, this is a thing. Everyone knows
name.
That listens. Yeah, Melodia. It does. It's not pronounced the way, but anyway, everyone knows that I screw folks' name up.
Hey,
on
I'm not worried about it.
We're going to take a short break, and we're going to come back with the favorite segment on Hot Grease, the Hot Five. Keep listening, folks. Welcome back to Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Nicole Taylor. Hot Grease is produced and engineered by Jack Inslee and Carlos Silgaro. Let me give a Southern girl's hug to Roberta's Restaurant, located at 261 Moore Street in Brooklyn, New York. The location of two sustainable shipping containers known as Heritage Radio Network. Okay, so you just heard Milkshake by Khalees. And as promised, we are giving you the Hot Five. The Hot Five is a rundown of five things on fire in the good food movement. Influencers, farmers, celebrities, business owners, and chefs dish on their favorites. We've been talking with Lauren Maluda.
Lauren Melodia is my name.
We've been talking to her on Hot Grease in the studio. I mean, you know, when I obsess, that's when it's all
wrong.
So dairy, we're going to talk dairy, and we're going to talk dairy and Kickstarter. We've had a few folks on Hot Grease that they come through and they are instantly funded. So you have a Kickstarter campaign going on.
Got a Kickstarter campaign.
And we're going to give folks five reasons why they should go to Kickstarter.com and give money to Milk Not Jails. So reason number five.
Okay.
Folks need to understand the Milk Not Jails program.
The project?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, what we're trying to do with this campaign is push the local food movement a little bit farther. We want to get political here and realize that there's a lot of systems that interact together that are all problematic. And with Milk Not Jails, what we're concerned about is that rural New York and rural America, really, is home to tons and tons of prisons in really economically depressed areas that used to be agricultural regions. And I could explain in detail, or you can learn more on our website, about why we think the criminal justice system is really problematic, but I'm sure most people know that the United States incarcerates more people than any other country in the world, and that's definitely a problem. So we want to diminish the prison industrial complex, and we think that one of the ways that we need to do that is by finding alternative economies or alternative industries to exist in those areas that are hungry for prison guard jobs.
So you would say number five is to go to Kickstarter.com and fund your project, because there's a connection between the dairy industry and the prison.
Yes, absolutely.
So, number four, why should folks go to Kickstarter.com and support Milk Not Jails?
Well, the thing that we're really excited about with this project is that we're trying to build a new urban-rural relationship. So people get really excited about urban agriculture. People get really excited about moving back to the land. But to us, the urban communities and the rural communities, they exist to depend on each other. Rural areas produce a lot of stuff. They need urban consumers to purchase those things. And let's face it, we're not going to grow enough food in New York City to sustain all of the people who live here. So we want to make sure we have a healthy urban-rural relationship, one that's based on food production and consumption, and not on locking people up for things that we don't really think are worth locking people up for, to send them to live in prisons upstate in rural areas just so people can have prison guard jobs. That just doesn't seem to make sense to us.
Okay, so that's number four. So people need to it'll give people an opportunity to better understand. Number three, Milk Not Jails campaign. Why should folks go on there? I absolutely love the video and I love your branding. Is that the third reason why folks should?
Well, I was going to say this is an artistic project as much as it is political. Yeah. There's a lot of artists involved in this campaign. And, you know, when you're thinking about social change and radical social change, you have to get creative. And having, you know, a bunch of policy researchers and lawyers can only get you so far. So we've infused this project with a lot of artists, people who do street theater, people who do graphic design, painting. And we've put a lot of energy into kind of branding this idea to make it easy and simple for people. That, you know, our slogan is, if upstate New York's economic survival depends on me, I'd rather drink their milk and go to their prison. It's that simple. And so what we've done with our branding is really kind of draw on the whole like good old 1950s American Rockefeller area, we can do it type mentality. It's really not that hard to change the prison system or the food system. We just have to get together to make it happen.
So I have to ask you this. How many days
are left Kickstarter? 27 or 26. We're 26% of our way to.
And what's your goal?
Our goal is $22,000. What we're trying to do with that money is buy a truck and print labels for our political line of dairy products.
Okay, so is that number two? So sure. is that number two that folks, if they give money, they'll do get what?
Well, I can tell you about all the fabulous things that people might get through the Kickstarter campaign. What we're building is a social enterprise here. So
number two, you'll be donating to not just a campaign, but a social enterprise.
Right. Yeah.
We'll
yeah, we want to give people, you know, some new ideas about how the urban rural economic relationship can exist. And we don't want to just throw an idea out there. We want to try and, you know, try it out, test it out. So what we're doing is we're mobilizing dairy farmers, because most of New York State's farmers are dairy farmers. We're mobilizing them to become actively involved in a couple of criminal justice campaigns in New York State. And in exchange, what we're doing is we're marketing their products in urban areas throughout the state. So we're in the process of putting together packaging and branding materials so that, you know, anybody can go to their local grocery store and find Milk Not Jails milk and butter and cheese on the shelf.
So the final hot five, number one on the Milk Not Jails edition of the Hot Five on Heritage Radio Network, a.k.a. Hot Grease. What would you say is the number one reason why folks should support Milk Not Jails social enterprise /project/Kickstarter.com?
Well, I guess the number one thing is that if you make a pledge today, you're guaranteeing that this project is going to go forward, you know, for the long term, because we've done a lot of market research over the past year and a half. We've done a lot of branding. We've done a lot of networking with farmers. We have all of the relationships in place to launch this really interesting kind of brand of product and political campaign. And all we need right now is a refrigerated truck and some labels to slap on those milk bottles. After that, you know, we're pretty sure that we already have coffee shops and restaurants and CSAs signed up to buy products through the campaign. We just need that little bit of infrastructure to launch this whole social enterprise.
So you guys, in addition to the folks going on Kickstarter.com, Milk Not Jails has an actual website.
Yes. It is milknotjails.wordpress.com.
Cool. Yeah. And are you on Facebook?
We're on Facebook.
So folks, just
there like, aren't there's no one else that's coined the term milknut jails yet, though we're hoping there will be spinoffs in other states like California, which is the number one dairy producer and has the biggest prison population in the country. So we're hoping there will be a milknut jails California soon. But right now, if you Google milknut jails, you'll definitely find us.
Cool.
Yeah.
Lauren, darling.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on Hot Grease. Listeners, thanks for listening to Hot Grease on Heritage Radio Network. Join me here every Monday at 3:30 Eastern Time. And until then, always take the road less traveled. My own beliefs are in my song. The butcher, the baker, the drummer, and then makes no difference what group I'm in.
Every spring at the end of kidding season, goat dairies across the country are faced with the question of what to do with their male bucklings. Because on a dairy farm, there's no role for a male. Often the most economical thing for these farmers to do is to cull the animals at birth or ship them off to the commodity market. Heritage Foods USA is embarking on a new project, No Goat Left Behind, looking to step in and fill this niche by creating a marketplace for these male bucklings. Visit us at www.heritagefoodsusa.com to learn more and to reserve your goat this coming October.
This is Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer. There's a lot of posturing and talking around raw milk these days and how great it is, but if you really want to get a full-on investigation into the pros and cons, the risks and benefits of raw milk consumption, here's a nifty website, www.realrawmilkfacts.com. It has a laundry list of FAQs, along with information from studies and reports from American and European science communities. If you flirt with raw milk consumption, this is definitely worth taking a look at. This is Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer.